I am Planta on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. John Pizzarelli joins me now. The renowned guitarist and singer has just released a new album for Centennial Reasons, 100-Year Salute to Nat King Cole, featuring the John Pizzarelli Trio. The album features several songs not previously recorded by Pizzarelli, whose discography features two previous albums saluting Cole, Dear Mr. Cole in 1994 and 1999's P.S. Mr. Cole. In this centenary year of Cole's birth, the album features favorites like Straighten Up and Fly Right, The Very Thought of You, Paper Moon, Route 66, among others. There are a couple of compositions written by Pizzarelli, including Nat King Cole and A Hundred Years From Now, co-written with his wife, the singer Jessica Molaski. The album is available where you download or stream music, as well as physical formats. Visit the Ghostlight Records website, ghostlightrecords.com, for information on the album, which is a release of its imprint, Ghostlight Deluxe. Mr. Pizzarelli will be here in Vancouver on Friday the 1st of March and Saturday the 2nd of March at the Orpheum Theatre with the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra. There are many dates across the United States as well. Between now and June, visit johnpizzarelli.com and go to Radio Deluxe with johnpizzarelli.com to listen to the weekly two-hour radio program that John hosts with Jessica, Radio Deluxe. It's a great program that showcases great music. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, John Pizzarelli. Mr. Pizzarelli, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
Pretty good yourself.
Very well, thank you.
So, congratulations on this new album. It's just terrific. I love the variety, of course, and this is the third tribute to Nat King Cole, right?
This is the third one, yeah. I think this is the one that could, in parentheses, could say well into adulthood.
Right. And he's a guy who, I guess you were introduced to him at an early age, and of, say, of all the singers that influenced you, would he be at the top of the list, say?
Oh, definitely. I think when, you know, I was playing a lot of gigs as, you know, I was writing a lot of pop music and things when I was between 16 and 22, 23, and then around when I was 18 years old, I started playing with my father a lot more and playing gigs in places, and I was trying to look for material.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really have any material that I, you know, that would relate to me as a vocalist. And when I got introduced to Straighten Up and Fly Right and found these records of Nat Cole, it changed my whole thing, because I realized I didn't have to sing Night and Day and I Get a Kick Out of You, which I wasn't ready to sing at 20 and 21, 22, 23 at that age. And so Route 66 and Fram Fram Sauce and all those Nat Cole tunes came so easily to me and made more sense for me as someone in his early 20s.
You mentioned your father, Bucky. Did he know Nat King Cole?
He worked on, I think he's on Send For Me and a song called Looking Back.
Mm.
So he did some of the later things. That would be about, I think that's 56 or 57. And Freddie Cole was, Nat's brother, was the one who told me that my dad was on those records.
Oh, really?
Specifically because Freddie said those were his first record dates in New York. And he said, your father was on those dates. And my father knew he was on Nat Cole dates. He just never knew the titles of the songs.
Mm.
So, but he always remembered Looking Back. And so he did get to see him. And my father was just as influenced by Nat Cole, the Nat Cole Trio, as I was. So we were sort of hitting it. When I was listening at 21 to the Nat Cole Trio in my father's living room, my father was, you know, watching me as a 21-year-old. When he was a 21-year-old, he was listening too to Nat Cole. So it was a very interesting, juxtaposition.
And on this album, the record of Body and Soul, you dedicate that to your father, right?
I do, yeah, because I played that so many times with my father that I never, you know, I played so much with him that he plays it so perfectly. And it was the last thing we recorded, and I remembered we were just listening to playbacks, so we were almost done for the day, and I went, oh, we got to do Body and Soul. And we ran into the studio to record it, and we did it in one take, and I'm glad I didn't think about it because I was really happy with the way it came out. So,
yeah.
It's You know, it's about, if my father's always at about a 98% on it, I was at about 75, but that was pretty good for me.
How is your dad?
He's okay. He's 93. He's not playing, but he's alive and well, and his hearing isn't what it used to be, but he's hanging in there.
The interesting thing is, I was preparing for our chat today, is that he and your wife Jessica share a birthday. Is that correct?
Yes, they do. They both are on January 9th, and it's also my parents' wedding anniversary, which I think was 64 years this year. So they, a lot of things on that day. My wife says she never gets to celebrate her birthday, basically, because it's always some landmark day for my parents or my father.
Now, your wife, I mentioned your wife, Jessica Bolaski, she co-produced this album with you. And
yes.
You work with her a lot. I love Radio Deluxe. I've just recently rediscovered it and over the weekend listened to about two or three in a row. Actually, three and a four in a row. And
Great.
I just love the two of you together, and I love the music that you guys play. I mean, there's stuff that you know, I've discovered thanks to the both of you and that show you do.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's, you know, it sort of was an extension of when we first met and would play songs for each other on our CD player. You know, we'd sort of make connections from song to song to song, and it didn't just have to be jazz songs. It was also pop songs that were like, or pop singers who sang jazz songs or that kind of thing. So it's sort of the Great American Songbook and beyond, and it turns out to be sort of an interesting mix of old and new, which we're really happy with.
And the both of you co-wrote 100 Years From Now, which is on this album. That's a new song, right?
Yeah, I thought it would be interesting. I always like to put original songs on the record, and I just thought it'd be sort of the idea of loving somebody 100 years from now, since it's Nat's 100th birthday, would sort of be an interesting idea. And I wrote the song, and I sent it to her, and I said, please fix this, because I think it's a good idea. And she sent it back with everything lining up. It's sort of like you give her the Rubik's Cube with about 8 or 9 moves left, and she makes all the right moves and gives it back to you.
It's such a lovely song, and the way that you've written it, the both of you have written it, it's not only a marvelous tribute to Cole, but it's just a song that you would think that he would do even.
Yeah, that was the idea. And when we set out to write songs in general, if you listen over the course of our records together or apart, when you see songs that we've written, we always like to keep the references sort of like in the 50s and 60s and 40s. So there were a lot of, you know, like those early Nat Cole songs would have Razzmatazz and Kickeroo and Frim Fram in them. And I even mentioned an old camera called an Agfa Clack at the end. It's a camera from the 50s. So there's all these little references that we like to put in to make it sound like it was a song that might have been written in 1954 or something like that.
Yeah, I doubt that 100 years from now people will be singing songs about emojis and things like that, right?
Right. You know, send me your email, you know. I don't know. It's there's something romantic about those images from the 40s and 50s that are fun to write it with.
You mentioned Freddie Cole a moment ago, Nat Cole's brother. You knew Maria, his widow, and of course you worked with Natalie Cole, his daughter. When you get to meet people like this and that were close to Cole, I guess if you're a fan of the guy, you might want to get to know him a little bit better by asking them questions. Is that something that you did when you encountered these folks?
I think I was luckier to ask Freddie more questions than Natalie or Maria. Maria was very kind to us, knowing, and I think she had heard our group on television and had mentioned that she really enjoyed what we were doing. And she saw me on a particular TV show where I think I was interviewed and even mentioned what Nat Cole meant to me. And someone had said, you know, these guys were just like your husband's trio, you know. And she was very complimentary. And Natalie, I was just lucky to be around. I was just, you know, so talented. But Freddie always had some interesting stories that he could impart, even just stories about when he was 12 going to New York on a train from Chicago to see his brother, and he said, you know, within about 20 minutes from being in New York, he was at the Polo Grounds watching the New York Giants and meeting Willie Mays because of his brother, mm-hmm. and all these interesting stories about just how famous his brother was. So it's sort of, it was sort of amazing.
The thing about Nat Cole it's obviously tragic that he died at such a young age. But when you go back to the recordings and you see him on television and say YouTube or videos of him, he just seems like a cool guy, a nice guy even, that nothing fazed him. I mean, as a vocalist, an incredible talent. Off of the album Nat King Cool, I just think it captures him so well.
Well, thanks. I mean, I think that was also, I wanted to write some kind of little jazz melody to the chords of Sweet Georgia Brown, mm. and I originally was going to call it Nat at 100 with a little ampersand, you know, a little at, you would put like for an email.
Right.
And then my son there's this guy, Nick Kroll, on TV who does this bit about a guy who runs a hostel in a Danish hostel, and he's always talking like this, and everything is very cool, and I like this. Uh-huh. And so one day I was just saying, because my son would always say, that's very cool, it's very cool. And I was going, cool, Nat King Cole, Nat King Cool. And I went, oh, that's pretty good, Nat King Cool.
Yeah.
So I thought that was, and it made sense to me, because he really was cool, and he still is, he's just so suave and sophisticated, and yet but just the epitome of just such a great jazz musician.
How do you decide when you're putting an album like this together, the songs that you'll sing on, the songs that are just the trio? Is that something that you think a lot about in terms of when you're putting the lineup together, say?
Well, on this one, what was particularly hard was trying to go, okay, what haven't I done yet?
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking for material that, new material, writing a few things, and then going, you know, I really want to do, the trio is really playing Paper Moon perfectly, and I wanted to make sure we got that arrangement on record. We really can have Route 66 the right tempo and the right feel now. I hadn't recorded Hit That Jive Jack in over 30 years, so I wanted to revisit that and, you know, in a much, you know, just in the fact that I feel like, well, you know, I've been doing this now for a while, and you know, I recorded that Jive Jack when I was 25, so to look at it now at 58 was like, okay, I got a different idea about it now, even though it's the same chords, it's the same everything, but I mean, I felt like guitar playing. I didn't play guitar the first time I sang Hit That Jive Jack, so it was fun to revisit a few things that I felt like I could land on better as a 58-year-old, as opposed to when I recorded some of those things in my 20s. So I recorded Straighten Up and Fly Right with Benny Green, I believe, and Christian McBride, and I knew I played it too fast, you know, those kinds of things. It was a different time even 25 years ago. So I was happy to look at some of that material and say, oh, I'm going to definitely do these again. And then even like put Hungry Man on the record, which Nat never recorded, but I thought, you know, that would be a song that he would have recorded, and it's a Bobby Troup song, and that would have been fun to put on there, so I did it.
You mentioned Straighten Up and Fly Right, and I went back on the Spotify, and there's a recording of you and your father. I think it's a live recording. And,
oh, right, from the Vineyard, yeah.
Yeah, and it's fun to hear you then and then hear you now on this album. You mentioned that you're playing it slower. I didn't really even notice that, other than I noticed that the voice is still the same, but it sounds richer. And I don't know how to explain that. I mean, better to ask you about how you feel your voice has matured, say, over the years.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I just feel, you know, having really only sung those songs in... the Vineyard records before the end of the 80s, so I was literally, I'd been recording on record about 5 years at that point,
mm-hmm.
and this is another 30 years later in some respects, so 30 years. So it is someone who's been singing a lot more and thinking a lot more about what I'm singing about and delivering those things. So I don't know if my voice has deepened or anything, but I do feel like it's just there's just something about knowing the approach better, even being more comfortable in a recording environment and things like that, you know.
Yeah, that's the other thing I noticed as I was going back to, you know, Dear Mr. Cole and P.S. Mr. Cole, and I forget the name now, the album from 1990, where you have one of my favorite records that you've ever done, This Will Make You Laugh.
On All of Me. Yeah.
All of Me, yeah. I mean, it's your voice really hasn't changed, and I'm wondering how did you do anything in particular over the years to...
No, I've been continuing to drink just as much.
Really?
No, I never smoked, so that's, I did smoke, but not enough to, I mean, not like for real.
Right, right.
So, I guess I've just been able to... I don't know. It's a very interesting thing. I just think I'm a little more in control of my voice than I was in those, on some of those early records too. So it's a little different.
Yeah.
But I appreciate that. Thank you. It is a compliment. I think, and I'm appreciative of that.
Well, that's one of my. This Will Make You Laugh is on my iPod, and then when I added Spotify to my phone, that was one of the first things I put on. The other thing that I had to look for was I Like Jersey Best.
Of course.
Which I think is just a marvelous, marvelous recording. You did that in Vancouver, and that's where I first fell in love with it. When you were with the symphony here, and I understand you'll be with the symphony March 1st and 2nd.
Yes, we're doing the Nat Cole show, which I expanded in the last, about 2 years ago, we put everything in. So This Will Make You Laugh will be in there, and For Sentimental Reasons, I think The Very Thought of You we just added to it, and there's a Body and Soul and Honeysuckle Rose, so there's a lot of fun things, as well as Straighten Up and Fly Right and Route 66, and there's a little Nat Cole medley that Don Sobeski put together that's just fantastic. So it's all of my favorite Nat Cole things all in one fell swoop, and it's always a joy to come to Vancouver. It's a great part of the world and such a great symphony, so I'm happy to be back after a number of years away.
I was looking on your website about the travels that you're doing over the next little while, and there's a lot of dates. And I mean, what is it like for you to go across the United States as you will be shortly, and encounter audiences that just love this music, that it is still important and still relevant today?
Yeah, it is. You know, it is amazing to me. They're coming out to hear the music, and I think. You know, for me, having done it a lot around the States, people know, are familiar with how I go about my business, and I think that, you know, it's the one thing that you can't replace. There's no substitute for hearing live music, whether it's with an orchestra or with a small group or whatever, and I think that's still an amazing, it's just one of the great gifts that we have is being able to go to a club or a hall or... out in the field and hear great music, and it's so I'm continually pleased to see people coming out and having those experiences, and I'm always hoping to, you know, enrich people's lives with the music that we love so much and that we can bring to them some joy.
And for you, knowing the material as you have over the years, I mean, it doesn't tire when you perform it, does it?
No. You know, it's funny. I'm in the middle of a 2-week run here in New York City at Birdland, and the previous week was a big band for the whole week, 16 pieces, and then this week is just a trio. And it took me like the first set of the first night after the big band week to go like, oh, there's only two other guys behind me. I got to get used to this. But you know, to have so much material at the ready, it's just, we've had some just wonderful sets of music, and so, I came home last night, and I stayed up for a couple of hours. I was so excited about how great it was, and the way people react to it, it's still something that brings me a lot of joy.
What is it like for you? I mean, you mentioned the difference between having a band behind you and then just the trio. But being at Birdland, for example, I mean, that's a small space as opposed to some of these theaters that you'll be going to shortly. I mean, do you approach performing differently depending on, say, the size of the audience?
I think the whole thing that I've sort of figured out is it's not that it's any different. It's the distance that you have to get used to. It's the reaction of people. So, like, you know, in a club, you can look right down and see the people in front of you. You can get the laughter of something or, you know, the direct response. In a large club, there's always about 3 or 4 seconds. I mean, in a large theater, you know. So you do... Sometimes you think, oh, I don't know if they got that. And then you remember that it's a larger hall. And, you know, as though it might not be as intimate, you're still having that connection. It's just a matter of understanding there's a little more distance. And when you understand the distance, then I think you're in a better shape.
you live and work in a city that we all love. Depending where we are in the world, you mentioned Birdland, the Cafe Carlisle. Do you and your wife Jessica? That's a regular spot for you to play, isn't it?
Yeah, Jessica and I always do 2 weeks in November there, and I'll do 2 weeks of the Nat Cole show there in the springtime. Also, it's a great little room. That's just that's 90 people, so that's as intimate as it gets in New York.
Yeah, and I mean, when you think of these various venues around the city of New York where you play, and you think of all the, I mean, these are places that your dad played at. These are places that people you admire have played at over the years. I mean, does that give a certain thrill when you say are in the room yourself?
Certain ones. It's funny. There's pictures on the wall at Birdland of Oscar Peterson playing on the very same stage you're on. You know, I remember. I think sometimes if you think about that, you can get you a little crazed. But, you know, we played a place called the Kumbwa Center in Santa Cruz, California. Mm-hmm. And I was with a new bass player and drummer. Actually, a new piano player and drummer. The piano player, Konrad Peshkutsky, is still with us. And I remember when we walked into the Kumbwa Center, Kevin Kanner and Konrad looked at each other and said, "This is where Ray Brown made that record with Jeff Hamilton and Benny Green. This is that place. Oh, my God." You know, so yeah. I was like, oh, you know, another generation has these feelings, and it's really terrific. You know, it's sort of interesting when you think about, oh, yeah, they all played on this very same stage. I think I'm sort of used to it in New York, but I forget about it in other places sometimes, and it's quite fun when the other guys remind you how they feel about stuff like that.
And throughout your career, early in your career, you got to open for Sinatra, and you knew people like Rosemary Clooney and George Shearing. As a fan, I mean, it must be cool to look back and say, think about the people that you've known early in your career, and now, you know, you're doing essentially what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Rosie Clooney experience was second to none as those things go, and that I wish I was a little more aware of it at the time. You know, I mean, I had a lot of fun with her, but I was so respectful of her, and I could have. And somebody said, "Oh, you could have done that. You know, you could have hung out with her. We all were doing this or we're doing that." But I was just sort of like very respectful of my space with her, and she was one of the great human beings on the planet. And Shearing, I had a terrific time with her. That was a couple years. Well, was it? That's over at the same time. That was 2002, so maybe just right after her was released, right before Rosie's death. And but Shearing was a lot of fun to be around because he let you in, and I think it was even his wife, Ellie, who said one day after I had tea with George after a rehearsal, it was tea time, so we had tea, and Ellie said, "You know, you're in, because George doesn't have tea with just anybody." And I was like, wow. So Shearing really, and Shearing was a jazzer, so he was really fun. He had a wild sense of humor, and he was just a great guy to be around and made it comfortable and so musical. And it's just that's an experience I treasure.
Did your dad work with Sinatra at all?
Yes. As a matter of fact, there was a tour of the States where Sinatra was promoting Hubert Humphrey. Mm. They did about 8 concerts, and I have a picture on my wall of the rehearsal at NBC that they did, and my dad's in the middle of the band, and there's Sinatra looking at the band, and I was like, oh, my God. And I said, well, what was that? He goes, oh, we did some tour. And I said to my friend, I said, that tour was that Humphrey tour, I think. They did like 8 or 9 concerts. And my friend, who was a real Sinatra file, said, yeah, that was that tour. You know, that's my father was just like, yeah, we did a bunch of dates. But he was on, and he did a date with him in Atlantic City. He replaced Tony Mottola. And I remember him saying, I never saw a guy sing like that. He was right with him, and just, he was really knocked out by him, so who wouldn't be?
Yeah, and you toured with him. Was this is some of his last years performing, right?
Yeah, I did 6 dates in June in Germany, the beginning of June. And it was like June 1 through 8, but it was 6 dates. And then I did a bunch, I think 12 more dates in the States in August and September of the same year, 93. So I got to, actually the best performance Sinatra gave, since he really was at the end of the line,
yeah.
I mean, and it's not his fault,
right.
But I mean, he sang a rehearsal in Atlanta that I still remember the 6 songs that he sang, and I went like, oh my God, what's going on? We're hearing a concert right now. You know, it was just 4 of us sitting way up in the back of the outdoor theater in Atlanta, eating pizza, watching Sinatra, just going, oh my God, this is a happening, you know. So
yeah.
There were a couple of moments like that.
Yeah, so they released some of the live stuff that he did, say, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and some of it's obviously he's aged a great deal, but you can hear just from the audience reaction just how electric a feeling it was, because it was Sinatra, and I think people paid money just to see that rather than say, or just as much, I should say, to listen to the music, right?
Yeah, but you know, there's the Sinatra record Live at the Meadowlands, which I believe is it's either March of 86 or March of 87. I still have my ticket stub, and I was at that concert, and they released it, and that was one of those nights where he just. It was an amazing thing where you felt out of the 18,000 people, he was singing right to you. You know, he was saying, here's what I can do right now, and I'm giving everything I got. And I was stunned by that. And I'm so glad they released that record, because it was really sort of, that was one of the amazing, one of those concerts where you went, oh, he knew that it was all coming out on the line then. You know, it was amazing.
So you would open for him. What would you do, say, between shows or for the concert itself? I mean, would you hang around?
Well, sometimes what we do, we only did about 25 minutes, and then we'd go hang in the, we'd go stand in the rafters, side stage, you know, and backstage in a sense, and watch from the side. But then every once in a while, Hank Catania would say he doesn't like too many people hanging back here because he makes him nervous. So, We would go wherever we could to listen to the show, you know. Sometimes even just in the dressing room on the speaker, listen to what was going on. Or the first couple of nights, we just went into the audience and gawked at them because we were just like kids, you know. So it was exciting.
So I mentioned a moment ago, I mean, I've gone back and listened to your early stuff and then now this new album for Centennial Regions. You know, I talked about your voice and that. I mean, in terms of caring for yourself over the years, are there special things that you do for your voice, your hands even?
Not as much my hands, but I think I always had warm ups and warm downs that I would do for my voice, and I figured out ways to take care of my voice when on the road. I think the last time I was in Vancouver with the symphony, I even lost my voice at the last day, just because I didn't know how to take care of it and what to do, preventive stuff, you know, ear, nose, and I've become an unofficial ear, nose, and throat doctor, so those things sort of help.
Well, you're someone that you're probably cheaper to go to, or easier to get to, I should say, without a
referral.
My wife,
my, yeah. yeah, my my wife and I are totally like, you know, what do you think I should do? What do you, well, you know, what? Well, take this and, you know, do that and this will work and that kind of stuff.
I listened to the Joni Mitchell album that she did.
Oh.
And that is not just because I'm Canadian and I'm a fan of Joni Mitchell, but I mean the spin that your wife gives some of these songs is just spectacular.
Oh,
just
thank
lovely
you very
to
much.
Hear.
We love that record. That was a joy to make. There was a fan of ours who came to see both shows when she did them at Lincoln Center and kept reminding me as the year rolled on, he kept saying, you have to make that record. And I finally said to him, well, do you want to produce it? And he said, I'll give you the money. So we literally could go into the studio to make that with all the people we had. It was thrilling. That's how we got Randy Brecker and Larry Goldings and Deduca de Fonseca. And it really let us loose to make the kind of record that we wanted to make. And Jessica's had all those great ideas, and it was fun to put down. And I got to play a little rock and roll and a little Pat Metheny and a little everything on that record. It was fun.
And that album, this album as well, this new one, for centennial reasons, I mean, these are really family affairs, aren't they?
Yeah, we've really come up with a good theory, you know, way to work in the studio. So when, she's a co-producer. She's been a co-producer for a long time, but now officially we're, you know, I'm in the room, and I say, well, what do you think? And she says, you got to do another one, or you got to fix this or that, or that's really good, and vice versa when I'm in the booth and she's working. So it really is something we enjoy doing so much and has become something that's really successful for us.
So as I'm listening to this new album for centennial reasons, I'm thinking of my favorite Nat Cole records as well, and I'm thinking of him as I'm listening to you, and 100 years from today, I mean, we'll still be listening to him, won't we?
I think so. I mean, I think, well, you know, talk about someone who really influenced jazz and popular singing. There's no escaping his effect on that, and I think if it's almost 70 years after his recording of Paper Moon, there's no denying that it's going to be around for 700 more. It's just too exciting and too, for lack of a better word, current. It's just constantly something that moves the soul.
This is a beautiful record. Congratulations on it, and good luck with it. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today, John, and we'll see you here in Vancouver.
My pleasure, and thanks for your kind questions, and it was just wonderful. It's great to talk to you, and see you in Vancouver, my friend.
Visit johnpizzarelli.com for more, and, of course, the Radio Deluxe program. You can hear that weekly at Radio Deluxe with johnpizzarelli.com, hosted with his wife, Jessica Malasky. The dates in Vancouver with the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra are Friday, the 1st of March, and Saturday, the 2nd of March, at the Orpheum Theater. The album is called For Centennial Reasons, 100-Year Salute to Nat King Cole. Go to ghostlightrecords.com for more information on the album. It's a release of Ghostlight Deluxe. And off of the album now, a track that John and Jessica wrote 100 years from now. John Pizzarelli joined me on the line from New York City and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plank.
They flip-flop on the bebop, sang a frim-fram, made a vow. It's undeniable, I'll be reliable to love you 100 years from now. You made my old heart have a new start, razzmatazzed me higher brow. Don't need an alibi, I'm gonna testify to love you 100 years from now. Well, you gave me that old kickeroo, and baby, did I fall. A century of loving you, well, who needs Geritol? You made this old boy feel the floor joy, more than life should allow. Says in my almanac that I am right on track to love you 100 years from now. 100 years from now.